Hi there, Billy Hindle here, the voice of Alice Dyer in the Magnus Protocol. As part of the Magnus Archive's 10th anniversary, Rusty Quill is hosting a special Magnus Live show at the upcoming Crossed Wires Podcast Festival in Sheffield. Join co-creators Jonathan Sims and Alexander J. Newell on the 5th of July for a new iteration of our live show, Statement Begins, where you can hear fan-favourite statements such as Anglerfish, Red Live, and gain exclusive insights into the creation and history of the show straight from the creators themselves. You can buy your tickets now, including limited numbers of meet and greet tickets, from crossedwires.live or the link in the description of this episode.
Hi everyone, it's Kareem, the voice of Simon Fairchild from the Magnus Archives. Today I'm here to advertise Beck's End, an upcoming new audio drama that will be launching on the RQ network. Beck's End is a folk horror audio drama about isolation, belief, radicalization, and poses the question if redemption is possible. When floodwaters swallow an idyllic English Lake District village, a stranded journalist finds herself trapped in a rising tide of fear. Cut off from the outside world, she begins to uncover horrors both human and biblical, lurking beneath the surface. If this intrigues you, you can support the creation of Beck's End on Kickstarter until the 17th of July. For more information on the show and to pledge your support, visit becksend.com. That's becksend.com. And you might recognize a voice here or there. Have fun and enjoy the episode.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Magnus Archives.
Hello.
I'm technically your host today.
Me too.
I guess. Well, yeah, we're co-hosting, but...
We are your hosts.
Okay, we are your host, I guess. So this is Alex and Johnny, and what we are doing today is we are going to be giving some commentary on a number of clips that have been selected by members of the company as their favourites for being either weird or funny or whatever. We don't know what they are.
It's a director's commentary with me, the writer, and whatever Alex is.
Also here, that's me. What will be interesting is we're commentating on a podcast to ourselves. We'll see how that goes. Commentarian-tating. Thank you, yes. So we'll see how this goes. We have no idea what these clips are, so these are going to be quite cold opens from us, and I suspect I probably won't even recognise a couple of them at first, so I'm relying on your encyclopedic knowledge, Johnny.
You are misinformed about
your complete
how often I have actually knowledge. Listened to these episodes.
On my third knock, the door swung inwards ever so slightly, and I realised it was not locked. There is little in my life that I regret quite as much as going inside.
So which episode is it, Johnny?
I pushed the door open as much as I could.
I don't know, there's a lot of knocking on doors in this series.
There seemed to be some sort of resistance behind it. The smell would have been overpowering, but by this point, I was almost used to it and fought down the nausea. There was no light.
Must be about Tim then, right?
And I fumbled on the wall.
Oh, it's... She's just popped with all the worms.
Before I flicked it on, I realised I felt something...
Is that it?
Soft and
wet
on the wall.
Yeah, it's number six, Squirm.
Unfortunately, before I had a chance to fully comprehend what I was feeling, I
turned on the light
and saw Toby Carlyle's flat in its entirety.
No, you're right. She hasn't popped. It's meat pie, you were right.
And tinged with red.
I can't believe this.
It was enough to see by.
It's fine.
I looked
right off the bat
and saw that every surface, the wall,
okay,
the
so
table.
Meat flat. For
no,
me.
Okay.
It's called meat flat, right?
Yes, but I need you to say meat apartment because it really sounds like you're saying meat flap.
Okay, meat apartment then. Meat apartment. So that's season one, right?
Yeah.
That's early season one, in fact.
I think it's like episode, I want to say 16 or 18, The Man Upstairs.
Okay, so at this point we realise that we might have a show that a few people might listen to.
This was still one of the very early ones that I conceived of, and I know this because I definitely came up with it when I was actually living in a flat, which I actually moved to my current house shortly after the series started, which is weird because you then moved in just across the road from where I had been living.
Always like ships in the night, never in a convenient way.
I was really quite pleased with this idea in the sense that I really liked the idea of leaning on, like, processed animal meat. Because so often it's like, oh, it's human bodies. Like, no, it's just meat. where meat shouldn't be.
So this was definitely, you were still in Yurt 1.0, I think, at this point. So,
oh yeah, classic Yurt.
So for anyone who doesn't know, Johnny is recording this episode holding a lapel mic, if I remember correctly.
I think we attached it right from the off.
But the attachment broke, don't you remember? For a while I had to tape it basically to you, and we were holding it at various points because we had to do like away from mic stuff. And you were under a blanket on a sofa with a clothes horse basically on your lap, I think, to record this episode.
Was this one in James Ross's apartment, or
yeah,
was it?
Yeah, it was.
It wasn't in your flat pre-asbestos.
Gosh, no, no, no. We'd already recorded this come launch, give or take, and launch was happening while I was homeless.
Right. I just remember that, like, this being the first episode where I was like, oh, Alex is going to let me be as gross as I want.
As long as you don't swear. I have to, yeah, with this episode, I'll confess, some of them speak more than others. This one spoke to me. It was a really good example of the horror where, yes, technically the pile opens its eye at one point, I think, and gives a bit of a blink.
Yeah, there is technically a monster.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. It's like, technically, but you could have had exactly the same story without that. And it would still be super scary, it just wouldn't have that one extra tiny little element, but it's always that one extra little element that codified so many of early Magnus episodes.
Listening to it now, there is just the smallest hint of just disappointment in myself that I didn't return to Meat Pile. You know? Because, like, I set up that monster, but like a lot of hooks in the early season, it didn't actually get picked up, it didn't actually end up going anywhere.
No, Meat Pile did. Meat Pile grew up big and strong and ended up in a hole eating everything that came along.
Oh, no, yeah, no, no, no. Like, I mean, hole full of meat was, like, an evolution of Meat Pile, but, like, Meat Pile as monster. I don't know.
Hello, I'm Jeffrey Meat Pile, that kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, I feel like it could have gone further.
When I went to the classroom shortly after what should have been their final tutorial...
Oh, yeah.
I found something on the desk. It was an apple. Next to it was a handwritten
bone
note.
Bone apple teeth.
Said,
yeah.
Thank you for teaching us the insides.
I figured we'd get this one.
I burned the note, just in case.
And the apple?
Season one music.
Did you eat it?
Do I look like an idiot? Of course not. I cut it in half first to check if it was off.
And?
Human teeth.
Great performance.
Inside were human teeth.
I assume you're talking about me, so
smile.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry, yeah, great performance, and you're there.
I brought you the two halves to see for yourselves.
Oh, good lord.
That's deeply unpleasant, yes. You can keep it if you want. As a proof,
we do not want it. I'm afraid it isn't really
gosh,
proof.
Season one, you're
someone
so arch.
Stuck those teeth in after the apple had been cut.
Do you think I would do that?
The actor for Dr... Dr. What's-His-Face. You know, Dr. What's-His-Face.
Yeah, Dr. What's-His-Face. I remember Dr. What's-His-Face.
Is a very good friend of mine called Martin. In fact, the character Martin is sort of lazily half-named after. Really fun recording, because obviously Martin does acting and voice acting and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's great to work with. But I just remember bringing him in, and like we did a recording, and Alex just looked so dour and said, we can't use any of this. And we were like, what? Did we do something wrong? Or our performances are not up to scratch. And Alex was like, when you are recorded, the two of you sound identical.
Oh, yeah! It was almost like there was speech jamming happening. You could not tell the difference at all because his slightly dour voice was your archivist voice.
Yeah, it was so weird because, like, to hear us in person, you wouldn't have said that we sounded... Like, we're both middle-class, young, white guys, and we don't sound massively dissimilar, I guess, but... It certainly doesn't feel like the same voice, but apparently when recorded, just the specific tones that get stripped out.
It's because as well, in the early days of Magnus, we were using a slightly different EQ, and that's because, here's a trade secret, so for Magnus, we actually just use the default telephone EQ for Audacity, but we add like extra compression and blah, 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 blah. But what that meant is it strips out the extreme bass and the extreme treble. And for the two of you, that just meant there was nothing left that wasn't just the archivist.
Yeah.
It's actually one of the reasons that Martin's pitched up at my end is because I end up getting lost in the shuffle as well if I don't pitch up a little bit. But you got to remember that this is early days and those defaults have shifted and so on, which is why it's a little bit of a fuller sound now.
I just remember feeling a bit sorry for Martin because he was having to put on this sort of weird, slightly higher voice than he normally would.
I did ask him to up-register, didn't I?
Yeah, and like periodically throughout the recording, you'd have to just stop it and be like, we just need to reset the voice because it would gradually like normalise as he got more comfortable with the lines.
Better that than slowly creeping upwards, right? And then I found an apple and then there were teeth in there.
The problem was him getting comfortable with the line, so every time he got comfortable, you were like, you need to stop doing that.
I mean, that's directing vocals for Magnus 101. I'm sorry, you seem to be, you know, anything other than uncomfortable. Let's go again. He was such a good sport as well.
Oh, he's
because
great.
He was an early guest. An early guest, it really was like, cool, yeah, thank you so much for coming. We're really, really happy to have you. Get under the blanket.
Yeah, well, there's a reason that all our early guests were, like, just our mates. It's largely that, and also, you know, we couldn't pay them back then, so, you know.
I forget. It's easy to lose track of how far it's come.
Yeah, like, so many of those early VAs are just like, I did some improv with, or, like, we acted a bunch in uni. It's great.
A few of writers I shared a course with are in here as well, dotted around.
Yeah.
I used to picket my skin. It was a compulsion.
Oh, yeah.
I would spend hours in the bathroom staring as close as I could get to my face in the mirror, searching for darkened pores to squeeze and watch the congealed oil worm its way out of my skin. Often I would end with swollen red marks where it had become inflamed with irritation or infection.
Gross.
Did I hear the song then? Was it when I was a child? Such a clear memory of a classmate telling me a blackhead was a hole in my face, and if I didn't keep it clean, it would grow and rot. Did I hear it then? Has that image lodged in my mind forever? Or was it last year? Passing by a strip of green they call a park near my house after the rain. Watching 100 worms crawl and squirm to the surface. Perhaps I've always heard it.
I do remember telling you on that recording, enjoy it more. I am enjoying it. No, like, sound like you're enjoying it more.
There was a hard limit, actually, to how much I could enjoy this one, but it kind of is also the reason that it works as it does. This episode was written roughly 3 hours before it was recorded. It was finished roughly 3 hours before it was recorded. At about 4 a.m, and I had not slept for a long time because I hadn't learned to manage my writing time properly in season one. So often I would be like finishing up the episodes just before leaving to go to recording.
You have no idea how hard it is to direct a script blind.
Yeah, I know. And I, you know, on the other hand, sometimes it did work. Like, I don't think Hive would have been as good if I had been fully rested.
There's another one that did well by that, and it's the one where I can't sleep with the billboard.
Yeah, well, that was Fatigue.
Yeah, Fatigue, that was it. That's not me condoning it, by the way. That's just me saying Fatigue is another one that had that feel to it.
To be fair, for Fatigue, that was actually kind of a deliberate thing. I'd kind of put myself in that position intentionally to get that slightly dreamlike sense.
Yeah.
This one was, let's call it a happy accident.
See, I really miss the Jane Prentice stuff because, so, we changed how we did the music. At first, in season one, we had a slate of music done, and then we cross-faded between them, but there was too much progression in it. It swells up and blah, 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 built in. Which at first was great because it was built to last at the standard runtime. But unfortunately, as things went on, we ended up having to bend and stretch and scrape it and crossfade so much that it actually became a headache. But later seasons are a bit more static drones. So they're as complex, but they don't have the progression. But for Jane Prentice and for the Piper, I got to use two of the tracks that we rarely get a chance to use anymore. One which has a real dirty sort of to it, and the other one is the creepy one, because they all had these names where it was just like creepy one, threat four, and creepy one was just the Piper's tune, which is a sort of like ooh. And I miss the season one ones. I occasionally have sneaked them in where I can, but for season five they've just not really been appropriate. But
yeah,
I sneaked them in.
Like, Elizabeth's too good for them now, like,
because Brock does the music, the monster. Here's the weirdest pet peeve ever. I don't understand how Brock does what Brock does, which is we give him the track and say, Brock, we need the music. And then he turns it around in about 4 hours. And I don't understand how, because I know the tool that Brock is using and I know the materials that Brock's working from. And I can't do it. And Brock won't tell me what the secret sauce is. But I'm now in a situation with Brock where I'm like, cool, Brock, this might be a long one. And Brock's like, oh, yeah, that's 3.5 hours or whatever. And then it's just, I don't understand.
To be fair, maybe he's sparing your feelings, because if you pushed and were like, what are you doing? Like, he'd just be like, you just need to be better, mate. Like,
just, yeah, Alex, just calm down. You're just very extra and it doesn't need to be all that.
What's the phrase, get good?
You know what? I fear you might be right on that one. God, what a damning indictment.
In my determination to chase a young man stealing a book, I had apparently completely forgotten my age, which returned all at once, and I collapsed slightly on the stairs. I began to climb then,
this
slowly,
is
towards the top of the bell tower.
Yeah, bell tower.
I have never been afraid of heights. But as I got higher and higher up those stairs, my head started to swim and my heart was beating so fast I was honestly worried that I was in danger of a heart attack.
This wasn't an episode that was recorded in situ, was it? This was in the office recording, right?
I could hear shouting
from
the bell
room. I do not remember, to be honest.
Alex is very unhappy with the reverb he's hearing here, if that's the case.
It sounded like a chant or a prayer. Most of it was in languages I didn't know, but I could make out the words Altiora. Vertigo.
I think this might have been a corridor recording.
If it's a corridor recording, fine, Alex is doing his job. If this is meant to be in the office, I am deeply ashamed to have
no, I mean that we recorded this in the office of different Martin's flat.
Oh,
with
God, I think you're right. That's a deep cut on early Alex. I think that might be real reverb instead of artfully crafted.
Yeah, because there were only so many...
Melt-in-the-middle reverb.
There were only so many sleeping bags we could duct tape to the wall.
Okay, so there was a phase where we had to record Martin, our CTO.
Martin with a Y.
Yeah, we recorded in his, not the one that Martin's named after. That's a different Martin,
yeah.
Obviously.
Keep up.
So this was recorded in a corridor at the very, very top of, like, I don't think they were ex-council, but effectively ex-council flats. So, like, think city centre, but super, super, super high up. And they had a corridor that had no windows or anything that we could record in. And every day to make the recording work, because the scheduling and so on, I would start my day, like I would be up and going at 4 a.m. because I had to lug all the equipment there because we couldn't store it there. So I'd get there for something like 6 a.m, then do setup and do all of the tech setup and testing and so on so that we could start at 9.
Then I'd arrive and we'd finish the setup because it was still going.
Yeah, and then normally we'd finish by 12 because then we'd bounce straight onto gaming. So I'd finish at 6, wrap down till 8, and then be home for like 11 because the trains would change. And that was just a recording day, 4 a.m. till 11.
I remember that corridor, the light bulb that Martin had put in his corridor was like this disco rotating thing.
The one that Martin deliberately put into his corridor.
It was
so
great.
That I know if this is Martin corridor, there were good chunks of this season recorded where people would deliberately put the disco light on and then record scary Magnus with like
it was
proper
fun.
Night Fever disco lights going.
It's great. Also, I really liked this flat because out the windows you could see all the way to like the City of London, and on a clear day. Well, not on a clear day, in inverted commas, you could just see this aura of smog around it.
It was grim. God, I forgot about those recordings. I was so extra. I put in so much. The amount of things that we have solved over the years with just brute force, just pouring time and effort in instead of being able to use anything else. I forget how much a difference the studio makes now.
We've become content and lazy.
You're right, we should get lean. We should be gone of all this frippery.
Absolutely.
Go back to recording into a polystyrene cup and some string the way God intended.
I liked writing this episode as well, just because it's one of those like old school kind of classic M.R. James style ones where it's just like, oh, he is a bookseller who finds a sinister tome. And a young man gets embroiled in this sinister tome, and he doesn't know exactly what happens, but he sees some strange things that he cannot explain. And it's just one of those, like, it's classic.
It's... Okay, this sounds like a compliment, and it's meant strictly as a factual statement, Johnny. It's a good example of, like, timeless horror.
Well, in as much as it is possible to have timeless horror.
Okay, fair point. But all I'm getting at here is... some of our stuff will date terribly because it'll be like a reference, or it'll be just a manner of speaking or a slang, whereas that one, I think, if I remember correctly, holds together quite well. But I'd have to re-listen all the way.
Yeah. I think of it as old school.
Well, no need to rush me.
Oh,
much.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Sure,
I knew this
one
was coming.
In the world. Besides, look at this dusty old thing. Expect it needs time to warm up. You don't use it much anymore, do you?
Tea?
God, no. Hate the stuff.
Why are you here?
To make my statement, of course. I know the Institute and me haven't always seen eye to eye, as it were, but I thought it was the least I could do.
Why now?
Why not? Big changes are coming, Gertrude, and I have to think about leaving something for posterity.
Fine. Subject is Mary Key, recorded 3rd of July, 2008. What is it regarding?
What a question. I wonder. Plenty to choose from, I suppose.
Take your time.
Was this my mum's first recording?
Did I ever tell you about my first Leitner? Of course, this was before he was collecting them, so back then it was just a strange book.
God, I adored this recording session. I can't remember if it was your mum's first. I don't think it was.
I think it might have been her second or third. I think her first was actually in your house, but it was, like, shoved in a corner because you'd just moved in. I think her first was the one about the Sinister Circus.
Yeah, yeah, this was in the post-homeless phase. Yes, you are correct. But this one was still in Martin's flat, and I remember because we had them in the corridor, and this was Carrie Cohen, who plays Mary Kay.
Yeah, oh, she's great.
And Carrie just turned up. And, like, we'd done the casting, we're like, yeah, this seems like someone who could do a good job. She played, like, a few witches in TV series and things like that. Then we start recording, and it came from nowhere. It was just like, oh, right, should I sit down and give this a go then? Oh, yeah, if you would. Hello. And it's like, oh!
There it is.
Oh! And it was just, every take was gold with these two. Absolute gold.
I've always enjoyed every time Mum has to record with someone else. She's always just in awe of them. And it's like, no, you were really good too. And I remember, like, she came out of this and she's like, wasn't she good? Wasn't she good?
Isn't she good? Yeah, I remember.
It's like, so were you. You were very good as well.
But there was just... You see, there was an issue as well that not many people know is that we used to have all of the RAW stored on basically an external hard drive that, long story short, as part of the whole everything went to awfulness, like a few things got lost in the shuffle. I've still got hope that I could recover them, but there was a bunch of RAW audio which is just your mum and Carrie shooting the breeze whilst we were doing all the tech setup, and they got into competitions of, like, cackling and things like that.
That,
like,
sounds about right.
Absolutely gorgeous, and I was actively distraught when we lost that audio. I still have, like I said, hopes to bring it back, but this was genuinely one of my favourite. But we were, oh God, we were still recording using Big Bertha. Big Bertha is a Alesis Multimix USB 2.0. It was a massive, massive mixing desk. And for a while in the podcasting sphere, it was the mixing desk. Like, I started the entire company with a 600 quid investment, which was in that mixing desk, and that was it. I had to save up for so long. Basically, it was the mixing desk, and they'd even discontinued it when we started, but I managed to get hold of it. And we had to stop periodically, because as with all tech in my life at the time, if it ran too long, it started to melt.
I remember how proud you were of the fact that you'd gotten, like, the last of this discontinued mixing desk.
It was
that was
so
the
hard
standard
to
in
get
podcasting.
Hold of, and it was worth every penny. But it was the fact that, like, I just punished the poor
until
thing.
Until summer hit.
Yeah, I just punished the poor thing. And then it was just, we'd had to take breaks. And it was like, oh, is this so that your actors can rest? It was like, they don't need rest. No.
Actors, no, it's so the equipment can rest.
My poor mixing deck. I actually still got it. It is still our backup, although I think now it's the backup of the backup. I could not part with it because
you say you're not sentimental.
Not sentimental about all these flashy humans wandering around the place, but Bertha, I fully intend to put in a glass case somewhere. As
she's
going to
be buried alongside you.
It can't be on top, I'd get crushed.
When he reached the entrance, he held up the book and placed it on the front door.
What are you?
I saw that cutaway panel of Mr. Spider's stained and bloody right-hand door.
Yeah.
And he knocked on it twice.
This still
I saw
feels
the words
recent
clearly in my mind almost more than I heard the sound.
Feels like we made this like
knock,
a few months ago.
Knock.
I think opened, there is this feeling of real distinction between season two and season
against
three.
Against that darkness, I could see the thin grey strands wrapped around the limbs of my former bully. And then, from inside, stretched two impossibly
long
limbs.
Yeah, because we're into the new music, you can tell, because it doesn't have that
and covered
progression.
In coarse
into
black
the new
hair.
Music, we'd started recording
for a second,
the studio.
There was almost the start of a scream. But the legs wrapped around him too quickly, and he disappeared.
Although you'll
into the
also notice that the actual
sight.
Total volume is lower because
it
over the years,
behind him.
There's a thing in the industry where basically it's gone. Called the like war on loudness, which is where advertisers want to come in super, super, super loud so that they grab your attention. But it can lead to issues at distribution.
Wasn't it the old joke that like our opening and closing was like 400% louder than our actual episodes?
It was, and it was meant to. And it did a good job at first, bridge the gap between these ludicrously loud ads versus the content. But then over the time, we've changed the way that we compress and the way that we do the audio so that now the vocals, if you compare season one vocals to later, if we were ever to do a remaster, season one would change radically just by virtual processing. Because I listened back to the early ones and I'm like, yeah, they're nice, but we cheated so much. It's stuff like, we have a tape deck. Why do we have a tape deck? Yeah, it sounds good. It also covers all manner of sins in the earlier seasons. Why do we have the tape EQ? So that I can strip out frequencies that at the time we could not record.
I remember when I was first pitching Magnus and I mentioned, like, I really wanted this, like, tape recorder aesthetic. And I could see your shoulders, like, visibly sag in relief.
Oh, yeah. We physically were unable to do what we do now for audio. It was possible. We didn't have the tools or equipment or time or anything like that. And so much of, and this is just art in general, isn't it? So much of the creative decision-making will be tied to not just what's cool, but, you know, what's feasible, what works.
What can we do?
Yeah, you're actively creating not very well if you don't. You've got to play to what you can make. And Magnus is so much not just determined by its time, but I truly believe that Magnus was a thing that anyone could have made from ground zero. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
we didn't have anything really in place.
But they didn't. We did, so suck it.
But you know what I mean, though? Like, it's
yeah.
Later Magnus, yeah, is a thing that you can listen to and go, God, I don't really know how they did that. Wow. But early seasons of Magnus really was just a labor of love. And it's like, okay, Alex, we need to have this sound effect. I don't know how to do that. I guess I'll go on Google and look up Foley or something.
To a certain degree, what I pitched to you originally was something that I'd kind of been intending to try and get made regardless. So there was an aspect where it was like, I just heard Sasha. Sorry, Georgie.
Did you
at the end.
Clean the kitchen?
Oh, yeah!
A bit. I mean, I can't exactly pay you anything. I thought...
It's fine. To be honest, it's nice.
Oh, gosh, yeah, because he was in the flat, wasn't he, at that time?
Yeah. But, so, like, I think a lot of the initial concept was me thinking, like, well, if I have to actually just go away and, like, find a way to just make this, what is, like, the simplest thing that I could possibly make? And I honestly think that's one of the reasons when I went, I want to do a huge number of episodes, you didn't go, nah, piss off.
Oh, yeah, like, absolutely. Like, we had a big talk because you wanted to make a bunch and was like, that's a lot. I remember actively saying, I want a long-running show. That's a lot. Like, a lot. But it was because you'd already done your legwork. I've heard over the years a lot of people pitch stuff. Yours is still high up there in, this isn't a very sexy way of describing it, most sensible.
Yeah, well.
Where you just rocked up and went, okay, we could do this because of this. I've got this because of this, this because of this. And it was just like, okay, yeah, like, that makes sense. We can do that. Yeah, I don't think I've had anyone pitch it as such a, oh, it'll be easy, as much as you
love
did.
Love to be a sensible creator.
Right. Keep saying it's not meant to trip whenever one bulb goes, but no, John, I don't want to bother the landlord.
Oh, Jess is coming!
You don't want to do that!
There she is.
I mean, you can if you really want to, but you're not going to like it. Sometimes not being able to see something is actually quite a good thing.
Who are you?
Well, my father called me Nicola, and then I killed him. So I thought I rather deserved to have his second name too, which makes me Nicola Orsinov. pleased to meet you at last.
You killed Gregor Orsinov.
Yep. He got really boring, and I'm a monster. I mean,
good line.
What do you want me to do? Not pull him apart?
Jess, I remember when I pitched the character, you were like, oh, this might be a tricky one to cast. And I was like...
Tricky one to cast, and you went, I've already cast it.
I was like, no, mate, I know he's playing this.
Actually, interestingly, I don't know if you're aware of this, this episode specifically, the segments from it, got really big on TikTok with the Clowncore crowd.
Sorry, there are some assumptions of baseline knowledge you're making of me there that I don't have.
Okay, I now have a decent number of people in the company whose job it is to make me aware of things like this. So, Clowncore is a subculture of people who basically do the, like, scary clown thing as, like, an aesthetic, whether it's cosplay or events or whatever, right?
Right.
A bunch of our audio is now circulating on TikTok because it's a good one for people to lip-sync to and cosplay to and things like that.
Yeah, I've never really got the whole lip-sync to audio on TikTok thing. I know it's just me being, like... an old man, but...
I'm Johnny Sims. I'm one of the few people who makes more podcasts than on TikTok. But no, in all seriousness, it's because a fairly prominent clowncore, like, costumer, very good, actually, really, really good, basically used a bunch of Magnus audio with no idea of context and just said, I found this really cool audio on TikTok and it was just perfect. And it was the knock, knock, you know, I am plastic and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And then off the back of that, this entire sub-community kind of stumbled onto Magnus.
That's fascinating.
But it's just such a good example of, like, the ways that I have heard people become aware of it are becoming increasingly tangential.
The, like, just the ripples and the tides of the internet are fascinating.
But yeah, I'm not doing enough justice to Jess here. It was a fabulous performance, and it was another one where she just rocked up and did it.
I'll be honest, there are sometimes characters that I have written, and then, like, I'll realise partway through that I am writing for someone.
Yeah.
And, like, to a certain degree, that was actually Gertrude. Like, it was that thing where we were having trouble casting her. And I was like, oh no, hang on, I'm reading this in my mum's voice.
Yeah.
Let's get her in to, like, give it a shot.
I forgot we really did struggle to cast Gertrude, because honestly, it wasn't intended. It wasn't like, and I'd really like my mum to play Gertrude. Like, we didn't even broach that until we'd actively...
Same with my dad playing Lightner. Like, in both cases, it was after, like, maybe a month and a half of, like, trying to figure out, well, who can we get to play?
And logistically, it was just really tricky and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But retrospectively, obviously, I'm really glad it panned out like that. The idea that it's Gertrude's your mother and Lightner's your father is really nice.
It's fun on a meta level as well. But no, Jess is one of my absolute favourite people. Brilliant friend, and I've been working with her creatively in one degree or another for, like, must be going on 10, 12 years now. So it was very much like...
I first met her through Mechanisms.
Yeah. Fundamentally, I was writing this, and, like, as soon as this character came up, I was like, yeah, that one's for Jess.
Yeah, God. Sorry, I'm just having a bit of a blast from the past. Jess actually also has a uncredited part in Magnus, which I don't think many people know.
I'm not sure I do. I probably do
Coffin
know it,
Song. We did. We had to do a sequence where
around.
It was you singing, me singing, but we all had to do the...
I remember she got very irate because she is a professional singer and was, and it was quite a slapdash recording.
Well, the issue is that she was too soprano as well. I was like, you're coming in real big and...
It smelt awful on the floor, and as the pink form began to move towards me, my resolve started to waver. It was far too heavy to be supported by its skinny, twig-like legs, but something still propelled it slowly forward, inch by inch, that familiar pink drool leaving a thin path for the enormous body to follow.
Oh, pig!
Right on top of me.
Pig!
Oh, is it pig?
My
pig!
Eyes and gritted my teeth, waiting to feel the pain of it starting to tear into my flesh.
You're right, it
monster
is
pig.
Instead,
I felt it
it's monster
settle
pig.
Next to me.
I love monster
the
pig.
The meat of it sinking into the spaces left by my position. It was pressing up against me and let out the most contented sound I have ever heard from a pig. The message could not have been clearer. Friend.
Monster Pig was weird.
Monster Pig was such
a weird episode pitch.
I love Monster Pig. I remember one of my housemates at the time who was listening to Magnus after that one dropped, talked to me and was like, you do know that's really funny. And I was like, no, mate. I wrote a horror story about the world's biggest pig. And no idea it was going to be comical. Although, like, I think it was one that I was quite deliberately trying to, like, ride that line, because fundamentally, comedy is a fail state of horror, and horror is a fail state of some comedy. It's a really interesting line to try and thread, to try and keep it so that, like, something is funny, but also grotesque. I think the, like, which side it falls is almost entirely down to the listener. Like, I know that some people have been like, oh, that pig freaked me right the hell out.
This is a blast from the past. I actually did a bunch of academic work on this. So I did a master's with the Central School of Speech and Drama for writing for stage and broadcast media. Very good course, I'd recommend. It was wonderful, and is the only reason I got this far, because a lot of it was just like, you gotta actually write. If you don't write, you're not a writer. That was a significant chunk of the course that sunk in. But part of it was I had to do a bunch on, yeah, the grotesque in comedy and how it interacts with horror. So there was a lot of stuff like Blue Jam and things like that.
Oh, Blue Jam.
Yeah, Blue Jam's weird and
brilliant, but also like,
yeah, very odd. And so as a result, yeah, Pig definitely hits that note for me, where at the end of it, it wasn't like, oh no, what have we done or anything, but it was just like, this is an odd one.
Yeah.
But in a way that was good, because part of Magnus as well is, you can't, I mean, podcasting 101, everyone wants infinite amounts of the same content that's also consistently fresh and new every week. I mean, all you have to do is give exactly the same thing.
You lose audience if you change, you lose audience if you stay.
Yeah, it's just, it's the eternal struggle, and Pig was a really, really nice one, because, yeah, you've got Piper and things like that, which are just like, straight down the line, this is scary stuff. And then Pig, or episode 100, Mr. Spider as well, scary as anything, but I also count as an unusual one.
Well, I don't know, like, I always feel the fact that Mr. Spider is so consistently up there in terms of everyone's, like, favourite episodes, I'm just like, it's a scary kid's book, it's horror on easy mode, like, I would have really struggled to not make that one really scary, you know? Whereas I feel like Pig, I'm like, no, this is me trolling an expert level horror run, and I don't think I'll land everything, but like, I'm proud that I gave it a go.
You have been good at giving me fair warning, where it's like, hey, FYI, I've got one coming up. It's going to be difficult to stick the landing, because you've set yourself challenges before, because the door one as well was one where you want, where you were just like, I just want to do a scary door with no addition, just a scary door. That's my challenge. So Pig was always hitting that note. I really did toy around with, is there a way to work Pig into season 5 as a giant, like, kaiju striding across the landscape, but it just...
'Twas not to be.
Yeah, I wish we could have got it together, though. Just the idea of Monster Pig just striding around, not actually doing anything, just there.
Just vibing.
Always appealed to me.
5, 6, 4, 8.
Oh, interesting.
4, 7, 4, 8.
It's the extinction.
2, 7. With each new number, my blood pounded and my heart raced, though I didn't have the faintest idea what they might have meant.
I don't know. Get rid of
it. I actually brought a notebook and pen, I now realise.
This isn't me reading a scary story.
So no wonder the waveform's horrible.
4 hours I spent patiently jotting down the numbers.
I hadn't even clocked that, like, maybe I was spotting that your voice looked different on the waveform.
I went through the sequence
part of it will be that I deliberately pitch up to hit the EQ better.
When I finally took
so I actually come out consistently a little bit louder for you, but we kind of compensate for
like
it.
Like a wave, leaving me reeling and dizzy. It took me a moment to realise how late it was, and how sunburned I had gotten in the process. Everything ached, and my heart pounded as I limped home. I'd been out easily twice as long as any time before.
I'm really surprised this one was selected, actually.
It's the first one that, like, really grabs the idea of the extinction, which, like, landed a lot stronger than I think either of us expected.
You know what? That's fair. Actually, yeah, it is an early extinction one, because everyone knows this at this point, that I dive down like research rabbit holes occasionally, just fall deep, and I'm like, ooh!
Oh, same, same.
And number stations for me was a real fascination for a long time, admittedly prior to this recording. But
I have a suspicion you might have actually, like, not exactly asked, but
I suggested number stations.
I don't remember if I was like, yep, already got it planned, or like, yeah, I can definitely do a number station one.
I don't remember. I remember suggesting it because I really wanted to do a number station one, and I'm glad how this one came out.
Yeah.
Number station's just odd. There's a few things that I just fell down the rabbit hole of because I just find them inherently creepy. Number stations, water towers. There's just something inherently creepy about water towers. They're just scary. They're like these massive tripods that just loom everywhere and everyone ignores.
I really enjoyed this because it's nice to experiment with the format occasionally. And I like this one because it gave a little bit of homework. Because I used basically the world's simplest crypto code. The world's simplest code with the numbers. And like eventually some people decoded it. And it like, I think it was like the world is always ending or something like that.
Oh, I don't know that people decoded it.
Yeah, people decoded it. Like, it was a very simple cipher. It's one of those things where, like, it's not in and of itself a particularly, like, terrifying message, but actually putting in that work always makes it hit harder. And so I was very gratified to see that coming out.
Well, it makes me think, actually, we did for a while, and this is something that I can talk about now because we know it's not a thing, is we talked about whether we should do, like, ARG stuff tied to this.
Oh, yeah. I feel like I've always been just on the edge of making an ARG.
Yeah.
You know, like every creative project I do could theoretically include an ARG, but they never have. And
oh, sorry, for anyone who won't know, augmented reality game, it's one where, like, I don't know, there's a code, and if you call that number in the real world, you'll get access to a recording that'll tell you to go to a GPS location in the real world, blah, blah, blah. But
they were huge in the noughties.
Yeah, we discussed it, and logistically we realised that we could do that, but it would actively negatively impact the podcast because it would be such a heavy draw on time.
Yeah.
And I think at this point we realised that just from writing alone, putting it together, it just wasn't feasible. I know since that someone's done it, actually, there's been a couple of podcasts that are doing quite well that really heavily tie into the ARG element and have a reactive story based on how far people get. More power to you. That's a very impressive achievement.
That's been a trend in internet horror I've been, like, not exactly following, but, like, periodically encountering, that's really fascinating for a while. Like, it goes, I mean, the earliest versions of that I'm aware that were widespread were a lot of the early Slenderman things, like Everyman Hybrid, 12 Tribes, all that sort of stuff. They leaned very heavily into this ARG element with, like, viewers getting packages and all this sort of
thing. Yeah.
Maxwell told me it is in our nature to fear the dark. And I could not disagree. For all my intellectual reverence of it, I could not deny that those few occasions I had found myself in full and proper darkness, my heart had trembled. And rightly so, he said, for
I think this might be Manuela, the light,
contemptible and corrupt. Surely then this fear of confronting the pure nature of the universe is right and good.
I don't remember.
Surely
this
fear
one.
Of the dark.
It's
is the truest
Manuela's
communion
statement,
that humanity
the
would ever hope
one
for.
Before they actually meet her.
That is words
Madison.
I felt afraid. And my heart soared in terror and elation as my eyes brimmed with tears. For I knew he spoke the truth. So we began to work together, to worship together in his church. The only church I've ever felt I truly belonged to.
Yeah, I confess, a lot of the dark ones blur together for me, pun intended. Like,
yeah, it's, I think, always been the power that we've struggled the most to properly make as scary as it should be.
It's just so frustrating because it's so easy in cinema.
Unsurprisingly, perhaps, in an audio medium, the fear of the dark is harder to convey. But I love going on a weird, off-kilter, cultish religious screed. Love it.
I'm sure I never noticed that before, Johnny.
Yeah. This one specifically, I can lay almost entirely down to the excellent podcast Apocrypals getting me massively into Gnosticism. There's a period, there's like a stretch of like 20, 25 episodes.
That's such a use statement, Johnny. Oh, you're still on Catholicism? No, I've moved on to Gnosticism now. It's all the rage.
there's a run of like 20, 25 episodes in season 4 where you could see that I was just going down this massive Gnostic rabbit hole research-wise.
So here's a question then. Do you remember when you stopped being afraid of the dark? I've never asked this question of you.
As in, like, in my actual life.
Like, was there a formative experience? Yeah, because there's some of the powers that I know, like, from our, like, chats or whatever, like, this speaks to you on this level or whatever, whatever. But for the dark, I've never actually asked. Like, is there anything that the dark formatively attaches to you in any way?
I mean, I definitely was afraid of the dark as, like, a child.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you are, aren't you? At some point, it swapped from being afraid of the dark to being... not exactly afraid of my thoughts in the dark.
Oh, more like a solipsistic thing.
Yeah, like, if I got into, like, a particularly scary or weird thought cycle, I found that I had to, like, turn on the light to kind of dispel it.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was that thing of, like, without any visual stimulus, my brain would just sort of go on these, like, almost like low-key panic attack. Not actual, but, like, that sort of loop.
I wonder if that comes out in the writing, actually, because now I'm thinking about it, I can't think of any shared victimhood in the dark. I know that there's been, like, multiple cult members at once, but has there ever been more than one victim simultaneously suffering to the dark? I don't think there has.
Not really. There was the shadows that tore that dude's head off under the church.
Oh, yeah.
I forget the name of the surviving witness there, but there were two people there, and one of them got their head off.
It's just thinking, because, like, some of them obviously lend themselves to, like, more people and less and so on. It's just, yeah, I've just realised with the dark, I never asked you. I never dug in on that specific one.
I think it is one of those things that, at this point, I find the dark to a certain degree a comfort in a lot of scenarios. And, like, I don't know, something about working night shift
it
for,
does
like,
change
2 years, you know? You just kind of get used to it.
It is still odd. It is still odd thinking back to you and me knowing each other pre-Magnus, just having met randomly at the night work. That's so odd to me.
It's one of those things where it's like, it's not as random as it sounds, because, like, James Ross, I think, was the reason that we'd both gotten this, like, weird night shift gig. Yeah.
It was a good gig for creatives.
We were already in the same sort of circles.
Hello, John. Apologies for the deception, but I was trying to make sure you started reading, so I thought it best not to announce myself. I'm assuming you're alone. You always did prefer to read your statements in private. I wouldn't try too hard to stop reading. There's every likelihood you'll just hurt yourself. So just listen. Now, shall we turn the page and try again? Statement of Jonah Magnus regarding Jonathan Sims, the archivist. Statement begins. I hope you forgive me the self-indulgence, but I have worked so very hard for this moment, the culmination of 2 centuries of work. It's rare that you get the chance to monologue through the voice of another, and you can't tell me you're not curious.
We're listening to, for everyone's benefit, you're listening to Johnny, okay, reading the character John.
Oh, is this me?
Archivist.
I'd completely... Oh, you...
Bear with me.
What a...
Channeling Ben Meredith playing Elias, bearing in mind that Ben Meredith's Elias is Ben Meredith's impression of Johnny.
It's such a looped, recursive nonsense.
Such a recursive mess. Yeah, this was a nice pitch. I remember you pitching this. This was a nice idea for an episode. Really, really clever.
It was the exact... That's me.
It's the biggest compliment I can give you, mate.
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely aware that sensible is the biggest compliment you can give, and I am also deeply amused by the implications of that. But yeah, no, I remember that the, like, how we were going to do this drop, this change, was something we'd been going back and forth on for, like, 3.5 seasons before we finally settled.
Oh, yeah.
My original idea was actually that this happened 12 episodes into season 5. Mm. The idea that there was, like, a false resolution at the end of season 4, and, like, the first 10 or so episodes of season 5 were just this entirely dead end. Not exactly a waste of time, but, like, a complete fake out. And then this happens, a third of the way through the season, and then the rest is just what the whole of season five ended up becoming.
Because, yeah, we did so many permutations of what season five could look like. We had season five is all the apocalypse, which is obviously what we ended up with. We had season five is a halfway fake out and suddenly it's there. We had season five is going to be all apocalypse, but only 12 episodes. Like, we tried a few.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, like, I think it came in at 15 or something.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, fundamentally, a lot of it came down to the fact that we weren't sold on being able to maintain an interesting apocalypse for a full 40-episode season.
It's a tall order. It's difficult.
Yeah, and to be fair, I think some audience might say that we haven't managed it. I think enough would say that we've done a decent job. It's given us permission to go experimental in a new way.
I'm glad of the attempt, and I know that sounds like a cop-out, but I am. Yeah. I would have always wondered what if we'd picked any other option than just doubling down, because we really had to compress the story structure in season four a lot to make apocalypse happen at end of season four.
Well, there's so much plot in season four, but at the same time, like, I don't think it actually feels rushed.
Yeah, I think there were, I'm trying to remember, I remember there were elements that we considered exploring that we deliberately lifted out, but I can't for the life of me remember what they are, which says a lot.
It's a weird one because of how the, like, the overall structure works with, like, each season being more and more character-driven and less about the specifically the statements themselves. As it goes on, more story goes less far, you know? Until we hit season five, where it takes a sideways leap and suddenly it's focusing, at least for the first like half, it's focusing a lot on the hellscapes with like character moments to contrast. But yeah, it was an ambitious change and I'm very glad that we did it.
So what's the deal with you two anyway?
It's an odd situation, but not a complicated
Ray.
One.
Hello,
shortly
Ray.
I decided to stay here. She arrived, wandered in from the chaos out there, and told me she was going to stay with me. I didn't get this far by pitting myself against the web, so I welcomed her in.
And?
And sometimes she cooks.
She cooks?
I don't know what you want me to say. It's a big house and I don't see her much. Can't even say which corner she's made her nest in. Whatever she's doing, all I can do is hope it doesn't wreck my little oasis. And if it does, then I hope that by keeping her in good graces, she'll at least do me the courtesy of killing me first. Anyway, let us talk of happier things. Or perhaps just take a moment to enjoy not being out there. You are, of course, welcome to stay as long as you like.
Took ages to land on the voice actor for Salesa, but Ray was such a joy to work with.
Lowry really came through finding Ray.
Weirdly, Salesa in this oasis was one of my earliest solid ideas I had for the season 5 apocalypse.
I am so happy with how that came out.
Yeah.
I am so happy because it was really difficult to get the casting through, and then there were equipment problems. We had to ship it out to Australia, and then the timing problems, and just from a logistic standpoint, that episode should not exist. And certainly, it was hard work, but I'm so happy with the end result. Like, it's really one of my favourite bits.
I think even by the time we were recording Piecemeal, which is Salesa's first, like, appearance, and you were telling me that I had to make it, like, 100% less sweary. It was all F-bombs all the time, first draft of Piecemeal.
US markets, they don't like it.
I was just like, he's a very sweary man, Alex. But, like, right from the start, I had this idea of Salesa as this, like, just very practically minded character, and, like, as soon as we started talking about the apocalypse, and I was like, well, we need to have like this rest in the center.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like, as soon as we said, I was like, Salesa's gonna be in there.
Well, structurally as well, like, you have to remember in mind is that season 5 was written, then pandemic hit. Salesa was originally meant to be, they basically dropped to the floor in front of him mid-season break, because originally we were trying to toy around with have the mid-season break and go for it. So from my perspective, it was the wonderful landing on the lap, oh hello, and then off we go for the break. So it still feels slightly odd to me structurally. I can't complain because we don't deserve it to have come out as nice as it did.
Yeah.
With all of the struggle, with all of the fight to make that episode happen. And Ray was an absolute Donna to work with.
For me, it was all secondhand stress, but I remember how much stress there was for Lowry and you, like, trying to get everything set up and finding the right actor, and like once found Ray, like getting the equipment and getting everything sorted, and like every time we talked, it was like, oh,
stress,
this new like little disaster. And then I got on the call and Ray started talking, and I was like, ah, brilliant, bullseye, we've got it.
And it was another one where it was literally, I think the only note was stuff like, it was either like speed up or slow down on a couple of bits, that was it. Ray was just great straight out the gate. It was genuinely one, like you say, where the stress levels were so high going into that recording because it needed to be grand. And the second that Ray started talking, it was just like, ah, I'm in an oasis. Good. Yes. Yes. Take us into the oasis. Yes, please. And on that nice, chill oasis note, I think we've come to the end of it.
Is that it? There's not. Yeah, you're right. There are no more coming.
That flew by.
That really did.
But
when they were like, oh, we've got
a blast from the
an
past.
Hour of clips, I was like, oh, that's going to take a while. But no, it's been a delight.
I'll tell you what, then, we'll just sit in, just listen to all of them, right? Once we're done, we'll just listen
okay.
to all
well, let's maybe... I've got to go to dinner.
All right, yeah, you go to dinner. Yeah. We'll see what we've got coming up next week, but I think we'll call it there then. Thanks, everyone, for joining us on this little
Thank
retrospective.
You.
Obviously, we've got more Hiatus content coming up, but... thanks for your time. Anything you want to add, Johnny, before we bounce off?
Not really. I'm still like, it's weird to hear like 5 years of your life and writing like condensed into an hour. It's disorientating, but I think I liked it.
Well, either way, we'll talk to you all later. Bye.
We were Voice the Archivist. Probably should have picked something else.
This episode is distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 international license. For more information, visit rustyquill.com, tweet us at @TheRustyQuill, visit us on Facebook or email us at mail@rustyquill.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi everyone, it's Kareem, the voice of Simon Fairchild from the Magnus Archives. Today, I'm here to advertise Beck's End, an upcoming new audio drama that will be launching on the RQ Network. Beck's End is a folk horror audio drama about isolation, belief, radicalization, and poses the question if redemption is possible. When floodwaters swallow an idyllic English Lake District village, a stranded journalist finds herself trapped in a rising tide of fear. Cut off from the outside world, she begins to uncover horrors both human and biblical, lurking beneath the surface. If this intrigues you, you can support the creation of Beck's End on Kickstarter until the 17th of July. For more information on the show and to pledge your support, visit becksend.com. That's becksend.com. And you might recognize a voice here or there. Have fun and enjoy the episode.
Hi, Alex here, founder and CEO of Rusty Quill Limited. In case you haven't heard, there is now a Magnus Archives novel. The Library of Jürgen Leitner is set in the world of the Magnus Archives and written by Nebula Award-winning author Premi Mohammed with our very own Jonathan Sims. The story follows Hugh, a university dropout, desperate to find somewhere to belong and his new job at an esoteric library. The books he must investigate for the enigmatic Jürgen Leitner are not normal, because the library is not a vault, sealed and silent, but a hive, alive, buzzing, and ready to sting. The Library of Jürgen Leitner releases October 27th, 2026, but you can pre-order it right now in the US and UK from your local bookshop or by using the link in the episode description. If you live outside of the UK or US, you may be able to make an international order for this first publication, but it depends on individual retailers' shipping policies.